Hi, everyone. I'm Alicia Krauss, and we are now live with our latest episode of The Conversation with Andrew Klavan. I am your host, Alicia Krauss, and our very own Andrew Klavan will be taking questions live for this entire hour. Please remember, our conversation is live for everyone to watch, but you can only be a part of it if you are a subscriber to The Daily Wire. How do you subscribe, you ask? Well, just head over to thedailywire.com right now. Click the subscribe button, then head over to the conversation page, and you'll be able to join us by asking your questions. Guys, seriously, we do take questions in the order that they come in. I bet you didn't know that.
We don't pre-screen them
or anything. We take questions in the order that they come in. So do not spam the system, because poor Austin back here has to scroll through all of them. And if you ask the same question a bajillion times, trust me, we got it. It's in the line to be answered. And if you're spamming him, it just really makes his job crappy. And I mean, the guy already had to run the marathon. Like, don't make him feel like he's dealing with that pressure all over again, okay?
Jesus. Strict.
I got to crack the whip. I am the mom of the office. This is my nickname. Be sure to tune in for the next month episode featuring, Michael Knowles all over again on Tuesday, May 15th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 2:30 p.m. Pacific.
I love this couch. I feel like I'm pitching Wu in 1910 Indianapolis.
I thought you were going to compliment my dress. I love this couch. It's definitely more comfortable than the chairs.
Yes, that's true.
We are here for the whole hour. Yep. So we got to, comfort is key.
This is nice, yeah.
And I'm really rooting for, we have water and coffee in these mugs.
Yeah.
And we were saying before we started live that we should really be able to have like a two martini conversation.
Absolutely. That would be much, much more interesting.
Do you think a martini is a masculine drink or a girly drink?
I like a martini myself.
So okay. How do you like it?
I like it up with a little twist.
Gin with a I like a vodka martini. My dad drinks a gin martini.
Yeah.
And I like it dirty.
Yeah, okay.
With blue cheese stuffed olives. And a bartender once told me that that was a girl's drink.
That may be a little girly.
The
fancier you get, the girlier
it is. It's not fancy. It's yummy. All righty. We have our first question. Here we go. John says, what is your favorite joke?
Oh, man, I have so many favorite jokes. I really do.
Children watching.
I will tell you my favorite joke, but I have to tell you this. I wrote an entire article about this.
Oh, really?
No one else finds this joke funny.
All right, try me.
All right. Wait, I should, let me enlarge on this.
Okay.
Only other writers find it funny.
Oh,
so I've told this joke.
Other screenwriters?
Fiction writers.
Okay.
I've told this joke for 10 years and nobody laughs. And then every now and again, I'll hit somebody and he'll just explode. And it's always another fiction writer.
Okay.
So the joke is, a man walks into a bar and he has an orange for a head. And the bartender says, what happens? And he said, well, I was walking along the beach. I kicked something in the sand. I picked it up. It was a lamp. And I dusted it off and a genie came out of the lamp and he said, I'll give you 3 wishes.
Mm-hmm.
He said, so I thought it was a joke. So I said, I wish I had $1 million. I got home, knock at the door, guy comes in, says, you've won the sweepstakes. Here's $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
So now he starts to take it seriously. He says, I wish I could sleep with every playgirl of the month for the entire year. Knock on the door, opens it. All the girls come pouring in. He has a wild party for a month. Then they go away. And he says to the bartender, this is where I think I made my mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And the bartender says, why? What'd you do? He says, well, I wished I had an orange for a head. No fiction. Mathis is laughing.
I don't get it.
But you're telling me
it's not a blonde thing. It's just because I'm not a fiction writer?
I heard that joke. I seriously laughed.
Does the orange represent something else in fictional writing?
I laughed for 3 days and I have told it. And then I was so eager to tell it to people and I would tell it to people and they would just stare at me. And then every now and again, I tell it, I just hear this howling laughter. And it was always, what do you do for a living? I write novels. I write screenplays. So I don't know.
Those novel writers, man.
I think
you guys march to the beat of a different drummer a little bit?
What I think it is it talks about the fact that no story can contain the irrational mind of man.
Okay.
That's what I think it says.
I love your depth of every answer. Even when you get a question.
You got to say something when nobody's laughing,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Jacob Hamilton says, with the upcoming generation of people going into politics, people's pasts cannot be hidden as easy as before. Besides illegal acts, what kinds of things would you deem immoral that you won't support?
I'm very loose about this because I really do feel that everybody makes mistakes. And if what we're looking for is perfection, I mean, if you take a trip and you put your dog in a cage on the top of your car, mm-hmm. and that becomes a scandal, you're not going to get anybody to run for office because mm-hmm. that's not even a mistake, you know? And I think what has happened is that people are just sick and tired of their candidate, especially because the media is so leftist, that the candidates on the right, every little thing they do, every little thing they say becomes an issue, where the candidates on the left, you can literally drive your girlfriend into a lake, leave her there to drown while you mm-hmm. change your clothes, and you're still the lion of the Senate. So I think that has completely neutralized the moralizing of the press. But having said that, I think that there are actions that you can take that show a kind of depraved indifference to people's lives. Mm-hmm. You know, if you pray on the helpless sexually, you know, it's not whether you cheat on your wife, you know, because that's a consensual thing. It may mean you're not as good a person as you should be. But if you prey on people who are too young to make decisions, if you prey on people you're so much more powerful than, that they can't fight back or say no or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think the things that indicate moral depravity, I mean, it never bothered me, for instance. I mean, it bothered me in some ways, but it never bothered me that Clinton had that affair with Monica Lewinsky. I just thought, oh, he's a sleazy guy, but that doesn't mean he's a bad president. It did bother me when Anthony Weiner was sending pictures to underage girls, because yeah. I just thought, like, you know, they can't rightfully say yes or no because they're just too young to know better. And so I think that's how you have to judge it. That said, you know, the scale has become so tilted toward the left that I do not blame right-wingers when they just say, we don't care anymore because you literally let Ted Kennedy kill his girlfriend and get away with it. Why should we listen to anything you say?
Interesting. You know? Yeah. So you know that statistically, women are less likely to run for office even when parties on the Democrat or on the right or the left try to recruit them, because apparently our kind of risk analysis is different in that way, and we understand that we will be attacked.
And men think they're invulnerable.
And men think that they're invulnerable. Right. And also, I think men are naturally more narcissistic.
And they're more risk. They're less risk averse. Women are more
risk averse. Michael Knowles. Oh wait, but his conversation is next month. Today's episode of the Conversation is brought to us by our very generous sponsors over at Skillshare. So I guess I should head over there if I want to become a fictional writer and get your joke.
That's right. If you study fiction on Skillshare, you will come back and watch this and you will say, that is the funniest joke you've ever heard. Nah, Skillshare can't do that, but it is an online learning platform with over 18,000 classes in all kinds of things, design, business, technology, and more. You can take classes in graphic design, social media marketing, illustration, mobile photography, you name it, they've got it. So whether you're trying to deepen your professional skill set, start a side hustle, or just explore a new passion, Skillshare is there to keep you learning and thriving. Join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare today with a special offer just for our listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for 99 cents. That's right, Skillshare is offering Andrew Klavan listeners 2 months of unlimited access to over 18,000 classes for just 99 cents, a lousy buck. To sign up, go to Skillshare.com/Andrew. Go to Skillshare.com/Andrew to start your 2 months now at Skillshare.com/Andrew.
Next question.
Yes.
Ready to roll?
Yes.
Joel J says, man, lots of J names today. Is it possible for conservative ideas to flourish outside of the United States? Canada is the rebel and Brexit seem to say yes, but when the U.S. tries to establish democracy in foreign dictatorships, they fail.
You know, it really is interesting. I lived overseas for 7 years.
England, right?
Yep, I lived in England for 7 years. And you have to understand that the word conservative there and in other countries means something entirely different. Because to be conservative in America is to want to conserve a very specific thing, namely the Constitution. So conservatives in this country are the liberals. We're the ones who want people to be left alone. We're the ones who want government to be restrained. In Europe, for instance, they don't have that tradition. They have a tradition of top-down government. So conservatives are trying to preserve things that we might not even support. For instance, class or racial divides. I mean, all of that is falling away and becoming illegitimate. But when you hear people saying overseas, when you hear them talking about conservatives, it's not the same thing. In the same way, when they talk about conservative Muslims and what are they doing while they're instituting Sharia law, you know, and so you can't compare it to us. If what the question means is, can constitutional republicanism take root overseas? Mm-hmm. I strongly believe it can. I really disagreed with the conservatives like George Will, who said you can't go over and plant democracy in Iraq mm-hmm. because they don't have the culture for it. I don't believe that. Mm-hmm. You can it may take a certain culture to get you to the point where you can invent the light bulb. You may need to have Shakespeare before you can invent the light bulb. I don't know, but you might. But once I've got the light bulb, anybody can use it. Mm-hmm. All you got to do is screw it in, right? So I think the same thing is true of Republican governance, that you can go over and start to use it. And even in Iraq, I think, you know, things are going a little better now than they were. And if you look at Japan, they did adopt a more democratic form of government. So you can do that. And I don't think the failure rate is as high as you think. I think there are more democratic governments today, maybe, than there have ever been. And remember, when we started, it was just us. Mm-hmm. So it definitely can spread, and it should, because it is what makes people happy. The democracy and capitalism are what make people rich and happy.
All right. Yeah. Next question is from Christian Silva. Dear Klavan, with no ease.
There's no ease in Klavan.
What do you think of Tucker Carlson's position on the chemical attacks in Syria?
Tucker doesn't think we should do anything. He thinks we're being drawn into a foreign war where we have no business going. I am not an isolationist. And the reason is because the history of isolationism is not all that good. Mm-hmm. Is it true that we overextend ourselves? Yes. Is it true that we try to police the world and we get emotional when we see children on TV gasping and dying and we think something must be done? Yes, all that is true. But it is our efforts in Syria and in that entire region that have crushed ISIS, which, let's face it, was going to have an effect on us eventually. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to leave before ISIS is thoroughly gone. When people were jumping on Donald Trump for saying he wanted to get out, he said, after we finish getting rid of ISIS. Mm-hmm. And so I do think he was being responsible. I don't think we have to stay there forever. I don't think it's our job to police the region. But it wouldn't bother me to see a response of some sort to the chemical attacks over there. I think they need to know that we're still paying attention. I think they need to know we're not abandoning the area to Russia and Iran. And it's difficult. You know, being the big guy is difficult. We have to be involved a little bit more than I think Tucker thinks. So I'm a little bit more less isolationist than he is.
Well, especially because you look at the geopolitical aspect of it and the involvement of the United States. You know, you have Russia that's trying to poison people, or successfully poisoning people in the UK, who is a great ally of ours. Then, like you mentioned, the connection with Iran and Syria and Russia is all connected as well. And you have John Bolton now at the White House saying that he's going to get involved with the Iran deal and make changes or tear it up. And so even if we want to be isolationist, this is the problem, I think. I love those libertarians out there that I personally have sometimes with libertarians of the hands off, don't touch. It's like, we don't live in a society where we can really do that anymore.
It's too small a world. It always really was too small a world. And it's getting to be, you know, there is a cloud. Even as we learn that free market capitalism and democracy make people happier and richer and countries more powerful, even as we learn that, there has been a rise in authoritarianism in Russia, in China, certainly in Iran. It has risen up in response to this reckless globalism. Mm. I mean, it's, you know, I hate to use the word globalism because it's come to mean everything we don't like, you know. But this reckless globalism where these people basically think that the ordinary guy doesn't have to self-govern because the experts can take care of it all. Mm. And the experts, if they're in Brussels, if they're in Washington, you know, Barack Obama didn't even blink before he told people in Oklahoma who could use the bathrooms in their elementary schools. Mm-hmm. My response to that was, you're a Chicago kid in Washington, D.C. You don't know who should use the bathrooms in Oklahoma. Shut up and run the government. You know, that was, and I think that the rise of authoritarianism is a rise of nationalism. And I agree with the nationalism. I agree with the idea of the nation state. But the authoritarianism is dangerous, and we have to keep an eye on it.
Okay. Yeah. We got questions still rolling in. We have plenty of time to answer them. But don't spam Austin. I mean, sometimes he's kind of mean.
Leave that to us.
He's sarcastic, but his jokes sting. But just, you know, don't spam him. If we need to, I guess we can go to the mailbag. So only mailbag questions come from our subscribers, by the way, which everyone could go to dailywire.com right now and subscribe. Oh, we do have some? No, I'm seeing Skillshare, guys.
They want us to do Skillshare.
Oh, sweet. Okay.
That's what that means. Okay.
It's a reminder that I need to take classes, apparently, in hosting.
Well, you know what?
Do they offer that?
Guess what? You know, they might. It's an online learning platform with over 18,000 classes in design, business, technology, and more. I have tried these. I tried the writing one just to test it, and I gave excellent advice that I wish I had known that I hadn't had to learn on my own. I even went, when we did the podcast with Knowles, Another Kingdom, I went and did a podcasting class and some marketing classes. And there really were intelligent people who knew what they were talking about giving video lessons. So whether you're trying to deepen your professional skill set, start a side game, or just explore a new passion, Skillshare is there to keep you learning and thriving. Join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare today with a special offer. Get 2 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents. That's right. Skillshare is offering listeners 2 months of unlimited access to over 18,000 classes for just 99 cents. Go to Skillshare.com/Andrew. Go to Skillshare.com/Andrew to start your 2 months now. That's Skillshare.com/Andrew.
We're keeping up with the J names today. Apparently, those Johns and all those guys, you know, jumping real quick here at the top. What is your opinion on the political pundit Mark Stein?
Well, Stein, of course, is one of the most literate and witty writers out there. I always like to tell the story of how when I lived in England, he was a TV critic. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting reading the newspaper.
They allowed him on television over there?
No. He was a newspaper critic writing about crummy TV shows. So he's writing, you know, he's writing this dopey stuff. And I remember sitting there with the newspaper and turning to my wife saying, I don't know who this TV critic is, but he shouldn't be a TV critic. He's just too good. He's so talented. And one day I was walking in South Kensington and I saw him because I recognized him from his newspaper photo. And I was a best-selling novelist. I was kind of a big deal. And I was going to walk up to him and say, son, you should not be writing TV criticism. You are much too talented. And I didn't. And then he went on to, of course, this tremendous career. If you're talking about whether I agree with him, mm-hmm. I think he is a bit of a catastrophist for me. I believe that whenever you hear somebody say, if current trends continue, I always feel that's the end of the sentence because current trends never continue. Mm-hmm. I think he has noticed certain truly serious trends and damaging trends going on, the death of Europe, the rise of Islamism. But that doesn't mean that things are going to just continue and things are going to get worse and worse and worse. So I'm a little bit more hopeful than he is. I think there are lots of surprises in the future. That's why they call it the future. You know, mm-hmm. we don't know what's going to happen. But there's just no getting around his terrific writing and his insightful view of Europe. And if you want to read a terrific book, you should read his book on Broadway. Because that's what he really loves and what he really knows. I think it's called Broadway Baby Say Goodnight. And it's just a history of the American musical. And it's absolutely terrific.
So do you regret not saying hello to him?
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm very shy. You know, very hard for me to go up to a stranger on the street. But I should have because he was one of those people, like Ben, like mm-hmm. Shapiro, one of those people, the minute I heard him, I thought, oh, yeah, that's a big talent. Yeah.
Oh, he's just sucking up to the boss now, folks.
That's the only nice thing I've ever said about Ben.
Yeah, yeah. Jacob Hamilton says, do you think Facebook is going to go bankrupt now? Of course, this is on the heels of Mark Zuckerberg testifying on the Hill.
Yeah, and he testified on the Hill and his stock went through the roof. No, I mean, what I'm worried about with Facebook, with all these things, is that they are being taken over by the left. Mm-hmm. And we are doing nothing about it. We're sitting here and kind of blinking and watching while Twitter shadow bans us and Facebook changes its algorithm to exclude us. Google drops our pages to the bottom of their searches. None of this. I mean, Zuckerberg would not be on the Hill today if Hillary Clinton had won. When Barack Obama stole information, private information from Facebook users, it was, oh, isn't he wonderful? He's so young, he even knows how to use Facebook. When people did it in support of Donald Trump, it's something must be done. We must regulate this this horrible thing. And it's just about attacking us. The left believes it should own the lines of communication, and the right is too stupid and lazy to stop them. That's basically what it comes down to. We should be in an uproar. We should stop them at every turn. And our billionaires, if we still have any billionaires, most of the billionaires are leftists now because they've caught on to the fact that leftism helps billionaires. if our billionaires were paying attention, they would be building their own Facebook pages. Guys like Peter Thiel would be building their own social media to make sure that we don't get silenced, because the internet is the best thing that ever happened to conservatism. It let us do an end run against the monopolized mainstream media, and now they're trying to close that gap. They close that gap through which our light shone, and they're trying to block us out again. And that's what worries me about it. It's not going bankrupt, but it might just become another leftist tool.
All right. Elizabeth Todd says, what is your opinion on what the U.S. should do in Syria? We touched on this a little bit earlier, but maybe you can delve into it more. She continues, with all of the countries in the world suffering, why would Syria win the help of the U.S. over any other country?
Yeah, I don't think we need to invade. I think we need to let them know that we're still watching. John Bolton, interestingly enough, everybody talks about what a war hawk he is, but Bolton has been very restrained about the idea of limited missile strikes. And so I tend to follow John Bolton. He's a very realistic, down-to-earth, hard-headed guy. And I think what he is kind of recommending is that we need a new approach to both Russia and Iran, and they, who are really the actors here, and we need to let them know that to penalize them for their support of tyranny and their attempts to take over the Middle East, essentially. Russia's presence in the Middle East, I won't say it's our fault, it's his fault, but we've allowed it to happen. We've been conned by him and gulled by him again and again. George W. Bush was, Barack Obama was. I don't know if Trump will be. Trump has been much harder on Russia than either of his two predecessors, while being criticized for not attacking him. But what I do think we have to do, I'm not so worried about whether we have a missile strike or not. What I think we have to do is we have to go to the real actors behind the scene and penalize them economically and make sure they understand that we will strike back if they compromise our interests. To be honest with you, it's not a question of helping people. We can't help people all over the world. It's a question of making sure that our interests are not compromised over there.
Okay. Tom Millard says...
Geogalactic Imperial.
Geogalactic. Okay. I mean, here we go. Continues my streak of there's always a word every conversation.
Well, that one I think is made up, so I don't
know. Okay. I just wanted to make sure. Geogalactic Imperial Overlord, King Klavan. I'm a former Catholic / current agnostic and hoping to be a future Catholic. Man, dude, this is complicated. What's your response to Father Michael's explanation of the church's stance?
This is Father Michael Schmitz, who I just interviewed on the show today.
I thought he was making a joke about Michael Knowles.
I don't think so.
I mean, Michael does kind of present himself as the sayer of all things Catholic.
Yeah, no, but this is I'm pretty sure this is Schmitz, not Knowles.
Got it.
This sounded like a knowledgeable, intelligent person, so he couldn't be referring to Knowles.
Oh, there we go.
But I think he was explaining the Catholic Church's approach to homosexuality. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because my approach to this, which is much more libertarian, but is based on similar reasoning to what the church says. And here's our difference, okay? The church says, quite reasonably, in order to know how to use a thing, you have to know what it's for. So when you talk about using your sexuality, you're talking about it has two purposes. One is the purpose of procreation, creating children, and the other is binding husband and wife together. That's Aristotelian logic that comes through Thomas Aquinas. Mm-hmm. It seems to me, however, that in Aristotle, there is a principle by which the things can be used for a greater good. So for instance, if I'm carrying a computer and somebody attacks me and I hit him over the head with my computer, that, even in Aristotle, is a fair use of your computer because it's being subsumed into the greater good of your safety. Okay, you're obviously not using it for its purpose. I've been in the arts all my life. I know a lot of gay people, a lot of gay people in my life, many of whom I love, many of whom have been my friends. It seems to me that even though the center of human life is a man and a woman coming together to create children, that is at the very center of human life, there is room for life to exist outside of the center. And it seems that if you get rid of all the other sins that destroy people, the promiscuity, the infidelity, the hurtfulness and use of force and betrayal, if you get rid of all of that and you're just left with two people of the same sex who love each other for life, it seems to me that their sexual urge could be subsumed into the greater good, even though you're not using it for procreation. It can be subsumed into the greater good of your affection for one another, and I believe that this is an attitude that the church needs to change, and probably will change over time. It doesn't have to homosexual relationships a sacrament as marriage is, because we understand that marriage is at the center of human life and is sacred in that way. Mm-hmm. But it should start letting people have the consolation of sexual companionship if they can't have it with the opposite sex, if their natural bent is to have it with their own sex. So okay. I disagree with him. I thought he was an eloquent and intelligent spokesman for his point of view.
Okay. Daniel Kutzar says, Dr. Klavan, what do you think about once saved, always saved?
Yeah, you know, it seems to me I'm not actually it doesn't quite make sense to me. I think that once you put your hand in Jesus's hand, he will not let go. Mm-hmm. Okay? But that doesn't mean you're still free. You still have your free will. So if you pull your hand out of his hand, you know, he won't stop you. I mean, he lives by his own rules, which is to let you be free. So I think let's put it this way. I think if you really, really, really make the effort, you can you can be unsaved. But what I don't think happens is like it's like a scoreboard. You know, mm-hmm. I don't think like honk up. You did this. That's wrong. You know, you're gone. No, that's not what I think.
I mean, re-say the sinner's prayer now.
Yeah, I think you have to turn your back on Christ. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that you are always free to turn your back on Christ. But I don't think it's like a scoreboard where like the trap door opens up. And it's like, sorry, you were saved, but you didn't make it. Like that wonderful scene in This Is the End where James Franco is being carried up into heaven and he starts shouting curses at the people below, so they just drop him. I don't think that that's how it works. I think that you have to make a considerable effort to leave Christ behind.
Okay. Please remember that this episode of The Conversation, like all of our conversations, is live for everyone to watch, but you can only be a part of it if you are a subscriber. And if you want to be a part of this episode of The Conversation or any in the near future, subscribe to dailywire.com now and join us. Also, be sure to tune in for our next month's episode featuring our very own Michael Knowles, you know, publisher at large. He says he didn't write a book, but he did publish a book. Yeah, Lord, I'm sure he'll talk about that. It will be on May 15th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 2:30 p.m. Pacific time. We like to give those people on the East Coast enough time to get home after work so then they can tune in.
I see.
And they probably have a drink.
Sure.
I'm going to really push for this.
I don't know. By the time I'd be finished, I'd be like cursing and railing, like telling old sailor
it's
stories.
It's equal payday. On equal payday, do I get an opportunity to demand alcohol? Payday? Yeah. So, no, I'm kidding. The next question comes from Alicia in Los Angeles. She wants to know. No, I'm kidding. Braden Thomas Kelly says, do you think that the Convention of States will be successful in a culture that wants big government?
It's a great question. And it's and I don't know the answer to it, but it really worries me. It really worries me. Like, I'm ready to have a Convention of States if Madison and Jefferson and Franklin will show up, but you know, John Adams. But I'm a little worried about the crew we have today. You know, I mean, you look at the Constitution of Europe, and what was it like? You know, 4,000 pages or something like that. And you look at our Constitution; it's like a page mm-hmm. on wrinkled brown paper for some reason. And I think, like, you know, they have lost the plot of what they were doing. The plot is telling the government what it can't do. Mm-hmm. That's the answer to having a constitution. And we don't really need to change the constitution. We simply need to rediscover it, I think. You know, from Wilson on and through FDR and certainly through Obama, the idea became that the constitution is old. What did, I think FDR called it a horse and buggy document. And I think if we rediscover what it actually says, you know, it has been so corrupted by activist Supreme Court judges, basically cowed by FDR and cowed by Obama, too, that we need to rediscover what it's doing. What it is doing is telling the government enumerating the government's powers. It's telling the government what it can and what it cannot do. And anything that's not mentioned in the Constitution, the government isn't supposed to be able to do. You know, it's not like, oh, we can do anything.
How dare you?
Yeah. So I worry about this idea, and I have never debated it with anybody or really heard anybody debate it. So maybe there's a reason my fears are unfounded. Mm-hmm. I would accept that. But as I hear it, I always think like, I'll do it when we can invite John Adams and Madison and Jefferson. But until then, I'm kind of want to just appoint the right judges.
You know? Okay. Pete Knoll says, Andy, do you ever get called Andy?
Never. My mother named me Andrew on the condition that I would never be called Andy.
Gosh, how dare
happens,
you, Pete?
Terrible things happen to people who do it. So, Pete, so long.
No, I'll still ask his question. Let's not be too harsh around here. Why can't Trump seem to rein in Congress, and what does he need to do to get them in line?
Well, Trump can't rein in anything because he can't rein in himself. I mean, Trump is a chaotic manager. Some managers this works for, certainly people in the movie business. There are people in the movie business who love chaos, love screaming, mm-hmm. yelling,
people like thrive
getting
off
thrown
of it.
Out.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, listen, I have not been hard on Trump. I thought Trump had a great first year of his presidency, but he is not a man immersed in knowledge of how our country works, right? He's really learning.
How dare you?
No, he's learning as he goes, you know, and I think that he didn't really understand that, you know, he couldn't just snap his fingers and have Mitch McConnell, you know, who's been sitting there forever and knows everything there is to know about the Senate. You know, he couldn't snap his fingers and have these guys jump to his rhythm. You know, mm-hmm. it wasn't going to happen that way. I think he has learned. He's gotten better. I like when he sits down with people. But even when he sits down with people and talks to everybody, you can see he says the first thing off the top of his head.
Like only, agreeing with Democrats on gun control?
Yeah, it's nuts. And then like, and then later on, when he gets back to his office and there are all these tweets coming in saying, you can't do that. He's like, oh, yeah, we're not doing that anymore. You know, so I mean, I think that he is not a person who walked in there with a strategy. He's not a person who walked in there with a base. This is also important, too. You know, he actually is an outsider. Hmm. This part of his pitch is true. And there actually is a deep state in the sense of a permanent government. There are people there who think that they are the government. And these people who just get elected every 4 years, they don't mean that much.
The bureaucrats.
Yeah, the bureaucrats.
Kind of sit there through all administrations.
That's right. That's right. And I think that I think he may have underestimated their power. He may have underestimated the need for allies. You know, he's such a narcissistic character that he thinks he can do it all himself. I don't think he has made the coalitions that he needs to do, to exercise his vision, his own vision. And so I think that's a problem. He's not a disciplined man. He's not a knowledgeable man. He's got some incredible skill set that I don't know how to place it exactly. So I really still have high hopes that he may accomplish great things and continue to accomplish great things, because he has accomplished great things. But I worry about him because you just never know what he's going to do next, you know? And I think and that is something that doesn't play that well in Washington.
Okay. Spencer Regal says, "Oh, Lord Clavin, thou whose name doth contain no ease." I feel like I should have done that in a bad British accent. "Do you think it's necessary to go through hardships and trauma, such as the severe depression you had, in order to be a profound thinker and writer?"
Wow, that's such a good question.
It is a really good one.
Yeah, you know, no. That's my answer. I think, first of all, you know, nobody gets through life without some suffering. Life is a hard affair. And if you're not suffering, it may be that you're not paying attention.
You sound like Dennis Prager right now.
Well, it is. Life is tragic. It's hard. And if you're not suffering at all, you may not be a profound thinker just because you're not paying attention to what life is really like. But no, I actually think that that profundity comes from paying attention and telling the truth. That's where profundity comes from. You need to know what is actually happening in life, and then you have to address it honestly. And I think that it takes many years to do that. I don't think I've never met a young wise man. I've met young intelligent people, but I've never met a young wise person. It takes many years to really just learn the ropes of how life works, because we all have theories about how life should work. We all have theories about what's right and wrong. We all have ideas about what people should be. But it's only after decades of seeing what people really are and what they will do and what they won't do and being surprised and being wrong. I mean, I think it's important to be wrong. You know, nobody wants to be wrong, but I think it's important to say like, oh, you know, I thought this, now what did I do wrong, you know? I think that is basically where profundity comes from, honesty and keeping your eyes open as you gain experience. And also, of course, reading, because reading is experience many times squared. And I think that those are it. I think that suffering does give you something. Mm-hmm. You know, you go through some pain, you gain a little bit of patience with other people if you're paying attention.
Learn from your mistakes.
Yeah, well, also you just realize that people are in pain most of the time. A lot of times you're talking to people and you think, why is this guy such a jerk? He's in pain. You know, it may not be an excuse, but at least it helps you understand people. I remember having, I won't call it a vision, but I remember having a moment in church once when I suddenly looked up from prayer and I looked at all the faces of these people, many of whom were my friends, and I suddenly realized that each one of them had suffering in his life. Each one of them had things that he had lost. Each one of them had worries. You know, and I could see them all on their faces, almost as if they were speaking to me. And I think that is what you learn with a little bit of suffering. But I don't think you have to worry about it, because life will provide the suffering at some point.
All righty. Raymond says, "Commandant Clavin." Wow, sounds very Hogan Heroes-y.
Yes, Hogan.
Both Commandant. "I attend the University of Toledo. I'm a history major, a senior. In my Women in U.S. History class, the professor lauded LBJ for civil rights and slammed Republicans. Should I let it slide?"
You know, I've been a big mouth my whole life. Mm-hmm. And every time I heard somebody say something in classes that I thought was egregiously wrong,
hit back.
I would always say something. As I've gotten older, I think perhaps that's not always the best way. It really depends, you know, to be Aristotelian, it really depends on why you're doing it. If you're doing it because you feel that it's something you have to do, you have to hit this person, and I don't know. I'm not sure that's why I would do it. If you're doing it because you seriously feel that it's a moment when the truth matters, it's a moment when somebody needs to speak up, it's a moment when people are being abused by falsehood. I mean, I was at a school the other day where they were teaching kids how great communism was, and I thought, that's immoral. It's immoral to teach kids that. It's like teaching them that Nazism is good, you know? It's an immoral thing to do. If you feel that that it's something you have to do, then follow through. You know, don't not do it because you're afraid, you know? But you might not do it because you think it's not worth the price, or it's not going to make any difference, or whatever. You know, it's really a question of your motives in that moment. If you really feel the truth needs to be told, tell the truth, but understand you're going to pay a price.
All righty. Daniel says, Dr. Klavan, how big of a possibility do you think it is for Russia to attack Israel in this next year or two?
Small. I mean, I don't think that's, you know.
They did recently blame Israel, though, for the gas attack on their citizens.
Putin is playing a game with a very strong game with very weak cards. He is a petro tyrant, which means that the minute his oil dries up or the price drops, he's got nothing. You know, he's got these armies, but he's got no money for them. He has just been depending on the gullibility of Western leaders. And the fact, when I call it gullibility, but it's really the fact that they don't want to get in a big fight. You know, they don't want to get in a war. They don't want to get into a showdown with a guy with nuclear weapons, with a nuclear arsenal. If Putin attacked Israel, I think that America would have to respond, and then it would be revealed how little there is behind who he is. I mean, what he is doing is you know, when you talk about the Ukraine, you talk about the Crimea, you're talking about kind of natural borders that Russia has. Those are the borders that helped them win against Napoleon. Those are the borders that helped them win against the Nazis, because he had to cross that border to get to central Russia. And by the time he got there, it was winter and you were frozen out. You know, so I mean, that he's taking stuff away that kind of historically belongs to him. If he goes after Poland, if he goes after Israel, if he goes after places that are now within our sphere of influence, I think he's going to be in trouble, and I don't think he's got the cards to back that up.
Okay, we shall wait and see. So the next question, comes from Caroline Allen. What do you think of the idea that we are living in hell right here and that our souls continue to reincarnate until we get it right?
I think it's great. I just don't think it's true.
I mean, that takes the meaning hell on earth to a whole level.
I guess that is some version of a Buddhist belief, or Hindu belief. But I just don't think it's true. I mean, first of all, you know, life is difficult, but it's very beautiful. And it's hard for me to think that hell would be this beautiful, that have this moments of such depth of beauty and such depth of joy and such depths of love. It doesn't seem to me that would make any sense in hell. It seems those are the things, exactly the things of which hell would be bereft, you know? So I don't think that that's a possibility. And secondly, this whole idea that we are reincarnated. I remember there's a wonderful movie, Bull Durham, a baseball movie, where Kevin Costner says to Susan Sarandon, why is it when people say they've been reincarnated, they were always somebody important? You know, nobody ever says I was the scullery maid. They always say I was the pharaoh in Egypt or whatever. And I just think that reincarnation is a fantasy. I mean, it's like one of those, it's kind of like multi-universes. It's one of those things, there's no proof of it. It simply supplies some kind of emotional need. And I don't see any reason to believe it. I especially think, though, the idea that this is hell, you have to account for the amount of love there is, and the amount of beauty there is, and just the amount of joy there occasionally is in life, difficult as it could be. It just doesn't seem like hell to me.
Okay. Brandon says, Dear Supreme Leader, you often talk about how the right needs to attempt to win back the culture. What do you think the average, everyday, non-creative conservative can do to assist in the culture war?
Well, another great question. Really good questions. One of the most important battles in the culture war is the battle for language and manners. And this is a battle that's not fought in Hollywood.
You brought this up before.
Yeah, have I?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, it's not fought in newsrooms. It's fought in everyday life. And it is.
Well, can I tell you, interruption, having been in a newsroom for a few years, it is definitely not a place where manners live.
I mean, I think one of the things that's so interesting about Donald Trump is the thing I like about him least, mm-hmm. his bad manners, is in some ways the most useful thing about him, because the left has co-opted, hijacked our manners to impose their point of view on us, so that to tell us that it's rude to call a man a woman if he says he'll call a man if he says he's a woman, you know, that's not rude. That's just the truth. That's just speaking the truth. And to tell us that it, you know, in back in the day, they would say it's wrong to open a door for a woman or something, or to stand up when she leaves the table, you know, all these things. I think that it takes a certain amount of courage. I've done this all my life, to stick to the truth. To say, I won't use that word. I won't talk about the objectification of women if what we're talking about is the fact that men find women attractive, you know. I won't talk about racial profiling if what we're talking about is simply police work. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm in a white neighborhood where most of the crimes are committed by black people, picking up a black guy and questioning him is police work. That is what the police are supposed to do. So calling it racial profiling is a way of making something that is actually good sound bad. Mm. So I think that without ever being unmannerly, without ever being rude, you can speak the truth. It's not unmannerly. It's not rude to say that Islam is the source of most of the terrorism and warfare in the world. It's not unmannerly. It's the truth. It's not phobic. It's the truth. It's not unmannerly to talk in a loving and brotherly way about the dysfunction in black communities, which is very much the same as the dysfunction in poor white communities, mm-hmm. The need for fathers, the need for the pain that divorce causes, the pain that single parenthood causes. So what I think is to address, for us to address each other kindly, but with courage and with honesty, I think is a tremendous blow in the culture war. To not be afraid of being chastised for saying, you know, men and women are different. All these simple truths that the left has managed to make unspeakable. Mm. You know, you cannot say that. I think we must say them. And I think we should say them politely and insistently. I think that is a place where ordinary people are fighting the culture war every day. This is why, even though I think that to some degree Trump is demagoguing it, this is why I think it's important that people say Merry Christmas. It's important that we don't say, when athletes insult the flag by not standing up during the Pledge of Allegiance, during the national anthem, that we don't say, well, they have the right to do that. Of course they have the right to do it. Of course they do. They have the right to do it because they're protected by the flag that they're disrespecting in that moment. And it's not right to do it, even though you have the right. So I think that these are the things that Trump has been very, very helpful about. He has been helpful about saying the things that people keep saying he shouldn't say. And I think that people on the right, when they have abandoned him because things he has said have been untoward and they've misinterpreted them as racist, which I don't think most of the things he says are. I don't think they are racist, actually. I think we shouldn't abandon him. We should stand by him. You know, he may be a blowhard. He may be an exaggerator. But I don't think we should allow him to be crucified as racist, sexist, all the things that the left just pulls out immediately. This is something that everybody can do. And I think we should do it fearlessly. And we should take advantage of the Donald Trump moment, too, to ride that wave. Because that is possibly, in some ways, it's the most important part of the culture war, not the movies and not the news.
Okay. Betsy says, why do the elites almost always lean heavy to the left? I'm familiar with the Island 120 principle, but I don't understand why otherwise smart, educated people support leftist ideas so much.
Because they don't hurt them. I don't agree with this 120 thing either, by the way. I the idea that the elites are in this kind of middle IQ, a little higher than normal, but not so high as to be smart. I think that, elites tend to have enough money so that high taxes don't hurt them and they assuage their conscience. They don't see a lot of the consequences of what they do. You know, none of the homeless people who have been caused by leftist housing policies are living in their neighborhood. Mm-hmm. They simply don't see what leftism does to people, but they collect the virtue. Hmm. So for instance, if you sit around and talk about with great concern and great intensity about the plight of the black man in America, it doesn't cost you a damn thing. Mm-hmm. And yet everybody says, what a wonderful person you are. And you're still not going to be confronted with the crime that comes out of those neighborhoods and the pain, the suffering. The people who get shot are going to be people in those neighborhoods. The children who die are not going to be your children. And yet you get all this virtue. I think that
the virtue signaling.
The virtue signaling. Mm-hmm. I think leftism provides a lot of virtue. And by the way, I think that the establishment of your own virtue, virtue signaling, is one of the key motivators in life. Mm. I think, like Freud said, it was sex. I think it's, you know, virtue signaling and not wanting to be ashamed. I think that, you know, I think those are key motivators that are not spoken about enough. And I think that that's why elites can afford the destruction that leftism wreaks, because it doesn't affect them. Mm. And they get the virtue from it. I think that's it really is that. And I don't think it's IQ. I think there are plenty of high IQ people who are leftists. They're just protected from what actually happens, and they can write it off. I mean, you know.
But when you talk about the word virtue, I mean, it's not the true meaning of the word virtue.
Well,
because
they are pretending to have true virtue, mm-hmm. but they are pretending.
There you go. Elizabeth says, when you are researching a topic, how can you distinguish a reputable source from a non-reputable source? If you are Googling something, how do you know which hits you can trust and not?
It has gotten so much harder. Mm-hmm. It has gotten so much harder. I mean, it used to be you could go to the New York Times and you knew you were getting a kind of leftist tilt, but you also knew they would give you the facts and then kind of twist them around to the left. That's no longer true. The New York Times is so far left that I'm not even sure I'm getting the full story from mm-hmm. them when I look at it. So it's become much, much harder to garner the truth. That said, you can check things out. And I get things from friends where they'll send me something and say, oh, you know, here's the proof that Barack Obama was born in Kenya. And I can disprove that in 30 seconds still, you know. I think you have to regard the source. You know, they're mm-hmm. still, you know, when I go to the Wall Street Journal, I know their point of view, but I know they're a good source. The New York Times, to some degree, too. I know they're far left, but I know what they're good at and what they can do. You have to learn your sources and track things down. And it takes more work than it used to, especially as Google has started to penalize people for being conservative. It has made them a less effective search engine mm. than they used to be. So it can be really difficult in this day and age. But I think that you know, if you do the work, you start to recognize certain things. For instance, I think I've gotten to the point where there are certain quotations that I immediately think are not real. If they're so perfect and attributed to just the right guy. So if George Washington suddenly says, you know, government is not virtue, government is force. I think, that doesn't sound like George Washington. You know, that just sounds like something somebody wishes George Washington said. So some things are just too good to be true. And you know, that's one way you can start to get suspicious. But I think you have to be suspicious all the time. I do this show every day, this podcast every day, and I'm terrified of walking on spreading fake news, you know? So I check very carefully, and it's gotten much harder than it used to be.
All right. David says, hi, Mr. Klavan. I have heard that the New Testament and the story of Jesus fulfills the prophecies of the Old Testament. Why do people of Jewish faith do not believe that Jesus is the Messiah?
Right. I mean, they don't, and they don't read it the same way. I mean, it's mm-hmm. a very, you know, we read the Old Testament as what they call a type of the New Testament. I can't remember what the exact terminology is, but it sets the prophecies that are then fulfilled mm-hmm. in the New Testament. If you don't believe that that's what was happening, then it's not proof to you mm-hmm. if you don't believe it in the first place, right? A lot of Christians don't understand that the Bible is only proof of something if you believe in it, right? And if you're not reading it in the way that Christians are reading it, then it says something entirely different. Mm-hmm. Listen, Judaism is a great and ancient faith. And they have suffered a great deal at the hands of Christians, which has been bad evangelizing. You know, so there's no reason for them to let go of it. They simply do not believe that the Messiah has already come. They believe he is to come. Mm-hmm. And they have a different vision, I think, of who he will be. You know, it now that I see it, the prophecies, it seems incredibly convincing to me, too. Mm-hmm. But back then,
I
can remember what it was like to just think like, well, you know, that you can say that's a prophecy, but it may not be a prophecy. And I think that it's just easy to do.
Okay. Raymond says, when you look at the history of the Democratic Party, how could you and Ben think that there have been good people in it since 1828? Man, he's going way back there.
Well, because I've met them. I can't speak for Ben, but I've met good people in the Democrat Party.
Individually, yeah, there's good people, yeah, not as a whole,
and
you're saying?
And I do think, I do believe that they have not noticed how far to the left their party has drifted. Mm. I mean, I was thinking when I was a kid, I believe people should do what they want as long as they don't hurt anybody else, that all people of all races should be treated the same, that men and women were different and women should be treated with respect. All those are the things I believe. And so I was a Democrat. Now I believe exactly those same things, and now I'm a Republican. I really do feel that the left has drifted so far to the left that they are no longer liberal. There's nothing liberal about them. We're the liberals. I say this again and again. People ask me how I became a conservative. I always say I'm a conservative because I'm a liberal. I'm a conservative because I want people to be free to live their lives.
Just leave you
and
alone.
To pursue their happiness.
All right. Ryan Bender says, the wonderful and magnificent Klavan. I'm wondering why free trade is such a good idea. I hear Ben Shapiro saying it's the best solution for foreign trade, but Trump's stance seems to make sense to me.
Well, Trump's, nothing is purely good or bad when it comes to the political world. The more, just like in our country, if you just eliminate all other countries, free trade makes everybody richer. Why? Because you have to please people to get your trading done. So you and I start to compete. You have to produce a better product than me. Then I have to produce a better product than you. Things get better and better. People are trading for what they want. It's all free. There's no force involved. It's not even a system, really. It's just people doing what they want and with money as an agreed on representation of the value of things. And it raises all ships. It's a beautiful thing. So it makes sense that when you look at the nation state as one of the customers, that we should trade freely within nation states. So that makes sense. When you start to say, I'm not going to trade with this one. I mean, it is every country that's cut themselves off from free trade has basically vanished as a force in the world, and you don't want that to happen. So that's why Ben and I are so in favor of it. I do believe, some of what's happening to Trump is unfair in the sense that he's right when he says we're in a trade war with China. He's not starting a trade war with China. He's just fighting back. He's right. China has been unfair. They steal our property. They put tariffs on us. And he's right to negotiate and fight back with them. Everybody's a little bit afraid of this trade war and afraid that he'll essentially be penalizing our producers. And it's a dangerous thing. And nobody's quite convinced that he knows what he's doing. I'm not. We're worried about it because we know how great free trade is. But that said, we are in a trade war with China. They started it. They've been doing it for a long time. They do need to be curtailed. I'm not sure tariffs are the best idea. I'd rather see trading partners unite against them.
Okay.
But I do think that he's at least right to notice the injustices and not just sit back. One thing that Trump gets hit on totally unfairly is he gets hit on his belligerence. When he's dealing with problems that he inherited. So they keep saying, well, he's just being too tough on Kim Jong-un. And I think, Kim Jong-un has been sitting there building his nuclear weapon like the madman he is, for decades, and nobody does anything about it. And so I'm not worried about Trump's belligerence. Let's see if it works. And I'm not entirely worried with his belligerence on trade. I want to see where he's going. You just never know with Trump when he's negotiating, when he's actually declaring a policy.
So. All right. We only have a few minutes left, so let's keep trying to roll through as many as possible. Susan says, Supreme Overlord Klavan, would you support a political system that offers more choices than just our two parties?
Here's the thing about that, okay? Because
Israel has that.
Yeah.
Britain.
Yeah. I think it is conducive to extremism.
Okay.
I think that it does mean that extremist parties rise, that they have a chance to move their way in. I'm not against it philosophically, okay? I'm not against it philosophically. If you want to start a third party, you can. It's not like it's illegal. It's just hard. It's just hard because the two parties are so entrenched. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that parties don't collapse. They've collapsed in the past, and they've been replaced with other parties. So that can still happen. But I like the reining it in. I like the fact that the nuts, the extremists, have a place in each party, but are not usually at the center of each party. Mm-hmm. I worry when I look at the Democrats, because it does seem to me that the socialists have taken over the center of the party, and that they attack our people who leave rude comments on blogs, who sound to me like they're senators and congressmen. In other words, our extremists are nuts. Like, we have these nuts who leave comments on blogs and, you know, say, like, we should do this and we should, you know. But their nuts are in government. You know, they're so far left.
Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren.
I mean, Sanders is talking, he's talking craziness and people are cheering him, but he's talking absolute insanity. So anyway, philosophically, I'm not against having more parties. In terms of just my experiential observations of it, it does encourage extremism, and it does divide, powerful forces so that sometimes the good guys get squeezed out. And I think that's a danger, you know.
Okay. Rosemary says, if you could pick two philosophers to talk and drink with, who would they be?
Oh, my gosh. Definitely Plato and Aristotle,
I should have guessed that because those were the two I was going to guess for you.
Yeah, you know,
Is there a prize for me somewhere?
I was thinking about Aquinas and Kant, both of whom I've really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. There are actually a lot of philosophers I like, but Plato and Aristotle said everything. You know, it's like everybody else is just kind of they're just riffing on them. And so I'd like to get together and talk about forms and how they disagreed on that. And
what drink would you choose to have with them?
Not hemlock. That would be the, I'd say hold the hemlock. You know, I would have a good whiskey, a good single malt.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Tyler Oakland says, the man whose voice would soothe anyone to sleep.
I'm not sure if that's a compliment or an insult.
I know. I was like, is that why I'm tired right now? Andrew, you talk about in your book about The Great Good Thing on how you had piles of books in the corner. How were you able to retain all of that information?
Oh, I couldn't. You know, I don't have a very good memory, but I kind of absorbed it, and so I knew where to find it, and I knew how to go back to it, and I would be able to say, here's something that I remember reading. Where was it? I'll tell you a funny story. Recently, I read a book I love called After Virtue, and I read it about 10 years ago, and I could not remember a word of it. And I remember loving it, but I couldn't remember a single word. And my son picked it up. He was visiting, and he picked it up, and he started to read it. Mm-hmm. And he said it was filled with notations. I almost never write in books, but I was so excited I was writing inside the book. And he got through it, and he said, you can't remember it because you just absorbed it. It became your philosophy. And so about a month ago, I went back and reread it, and I got a paragraph into it and remembered the whole thing. And in fact, I had just absorbed it. So I didn't worry too much about remembering things. I haven't got a computerized perfect memory. I wish I did, but I just don't. But I think it's a little bit more conducive to what I am, which is an artist, a writer of novels, to get impressions of things and then be able to return them in my own original way. And I think that's the way it worked out for me.
All right. Last question.
All right.
I can't believe we made it. We finally made it.
Yeah.
Jacob says, I come from a Jewish background, but I was baptized this Easter. How do I reconcile this with my Jewish family? My father did not smile throughout the entire service and left early. Please help.
Oh, it's so tough. It's so tough. I mean, you do have to remember and respect the fact that Jews came to think of Christians as the enemy, especially Jews from Europe. Like, they haven't really even figured out yet that American evangelicals, I remember American evangelicals saying to me, like, why are Jews angry at us? We all have the same God and we love them, you know? Mm-hmm. And they think back to Europe when, the Crusaders would stop off on their way to killing Muslims. They would stop off and kill the Jews in their own country, saying, how can we go overseas and kill the infidel before we've killed the infidel at home? And I think that there's a memory of that in the blood. And, you know, people's heritages are very important to them. So I think you need to explain, if you can, to your father. I mean, my experience was, of course, that just as I was about to tell my father, he fell into his final illness and died. So I never told him because it would have broken his heart, in the last 6 months of his life. So I kind of got out of the confrontation. But I think if you can go to him and make him understand that this is not a rejection of his faith, it is the full expression of your faith, full expression of how you think God is, of who you think God is, that you're not condemning Judaism, that you're not partaking of any anti-Semitism, that you will continue to reject anti-Semitism, but you must worship God as you have found him. Maybe he'll understand and maybe not. Maybe Jesus pointed out that he was going to divide us in many ways, and you may find yourself divided from your father in this way. And it is, and Christ talked about it in the Gospels. He said, this is going to happen. But hopefully, if you explain it right and make him understand that you're not rejecting him, you're not rejecting your heritage, you're simply worshiping God as you find him, maybe he'll understand.
I have to say, I'm surprised, and it's a huge deal that he agreed to attend the service.
Yeah, no,
I think that's a huge step.
That actually shows that he might be open to it. He might actually be open to reconciliation. He might just be, his own imagination might be going around and around and thinking things that aren't true, and you might be able to explain that to him.
All right. Good luck, Jacob. And thank you so much for being here.
It was a pleasure.
We'll be here in another couple of months. But next month, I will be sitting down with our very own Michael Knowles on Tuesday, May 15th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 2:30 p.m. Pacific. I thank God that it is not the month of Valentine's Day, so I will not have to see him pantsless again.
That thing will live in infamy.
I hope
he never runs for office. It's
I don't know. It could be like the Andrew Breitbart motto, though. Just put it all out there.
Put it all out there.
Like, yeah. I did this, I did this, I did this, and then he'll win like Donald Trump. Dear Lord, help us all. President Knowles? No, not okay. This has been fun. It flew by. Thank you for being here today. Thank you all for watching and participating. This episode of The Conversation with Andrew Klavan. I'm Elisha Krauss, and we'll see you next month.